Goeienaand weer, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Ons span vanavond bestaan uit Jim Adams, daar in Maryland in Amerika, en dan het ons vir professor Mati Hofman in Bloemfontein. Ons gaan eers luister na Kobus Olkers en ruimte en weernuus. Kobus.
Goeienaand en goeienaand luisteraars. Ja, kom ons kyk 'n bietjie wat het die son hierdie week vir ons. Daar's 'n groot, redelike groot komplekse magnetiese area op die kant van die son wat na die aarde toe wys. Hy is in 'n geo-effektiewe posisie, maar hy is nie so vreeslik kompleks nie. Hy is baie mooi diepel om die waarheid te sê. En dit lyk nie vir my asof ons enige probleme gaan hê met hom nie. Hy lyk maar net mooi as 'n mens na hom kyk op die oomblik. Dan is daar enetjie wat nou so pas oor die rand van die son gekom het. Hy lyk vir my asof hy dalk aan kompleks raak. Hy is hoofsaaklik noord georiënteer en dan is daar so suidpool wat so deur hom probeer wriemel. Dit is die soort van ding wat gewoonlik vir ons kan korona massa uitbarstings gee. Hy sal in geval nie binne die volgende week geo-effektief raak nie, maar as hy wel 'n uitbarsting het, sal ons die ekstra weergawe daarvan kry. En ons ionosfeer sal het weet met een stampie of twee van sy kant af. Dan wat filamente betref, sit hulle sommer so soos golwe in een rij op die son op hierdie stadium. Dit lyk een bietjie onstabiel hier in die geo-effektiewe areas. En ek verwag dat ons een of ander fakkel gaan sien met filament wat of gaan platval of gaan loskom van die son af. En dan natuurlijk het ons coronagaatjies. Daar is een kleintje wat geo-effektief is, wat eigenlijk geen effect op ons behoort te heen nie. Dan is daar even groter een. Hy is nou so op pad na die middel van die son toe, na die centerlijn van die son. Hy kan later hierdie week vir ons een bietjie sonwind gee. Sy magnetiese oriëntasie lyk vir my hoofsaaklik gesond vir ons, so ek glo nie ons gaan 'n probleem daar hê nie. En dan al wat nog oorbly is die sonvlekkies wat kom. Ek sien daar's nog een so oor die horison van die son aan die agterkant. Hy sal so binne die volgende paar dae gaan hy ook oor die rand verskyn en dan sal ons maar sien hoe lyk hy en dan of hy kompleks is of nie, sal ons maar met volgende week moet sien. Nou ja, dit is ons story vir hierdie week. Geen groot probleme wat ons voorsien nie. Goeienaand allemaal.
Soos gewoonlik Kobus Olkers op sy pos daar in Florida in Amerika met ruimte weernuus. Ons span vanavond is Jim Adams, daar in Maryland in die VSA. Goeienaand Jim.
Goeienaand, Henny.
En dan natuurlijk professor Mati Hofman in Bloemfontein, een baie koue Bloemfontein neem ek aan. Naand Mati?
Naand Henny, ja, ek kon die week nou die eerste keer iets in my motor die ryp skryf, net om te sien, dit is nie meer dou nie, dit is nou ryp. Nou, ons huis is tamelijk hoog geleë, so daar's ander plekke wat nou al heel wat vroeër ryp gehad het. En op die stadium het die tuine daarom nog nie te seer gekry nie, maar ons weet dit gaan kom en dan moet dit maar net oorleef.
Ja, right. We are going to talk about an interesting subject and that is prioritizing space missions. How do you do that? That must be quite a job, isn't it, Jim?
Well, even just in the United States, it's quite a job. But if you think about space exploration, it's really planet Earth that's exploring our solar system and the worlds beyond. And so, yeah, it is. It's a huge undertaking. Countries that want to coordinate with other countries and partnerships and maybe a little competition. And so, yeah, so this is a great topic to talk about this week.
I want to ask you, what about duplication?
Yeah. Well, you know, these missions are so expensive that, generally speaking, countries try not to duplicate but complement. And so, as an example, you know, we might say, well, We're going to launch this observer to Mars, MAVEN, but we don't have the ability to measure certain qualities of the gases in the atmosphere. And so Europe came alongside, and they said, well, we've been wanting to use some of the technology we've been using here in orbit around Earth at Mars, and so we will fill that gap for the broader science community. And then what happens then when that happens, when they do that, there's missions that get launched. And so the European Trace Gas Orbiter was an answer to that. But scientists around the world then get to share in all of that data. So you get the collective brain power of everybody working on these missions and trying to understand the nuances of the science around the different planets and across the solar system.
Jim, can I ask you, you mentioned the missions are very expensive. Can you demonstrate that with a few examples of say, a mission just around the Earth, putting a satellite, Earth observing satellite in orbit around the Earth and operating that for, say, 10 years compared to a mission to Mars? Do you have a difference between major missions that happens only once in a few years and the cost for more regular missions? And what type of monies are we talking about?
Yeah. So let's just start with planetary science. So without the comparison to the Earth missions, there's three classes of missions in planetary science. And, you know, they were originally called small, medium, and large, which wasn't very innovative. And so the community came up with Discovery class missions, New Frontiers class missions, and flagship missions. And so the Discovery class missions are on the order of $500 million, not including the cost of the launch vehicle. Then the New Frontiers class missions are on the order of $1 billion, so double a Discovery class mission. And then anything that's over $1 billion or more, they call a flagship, which would be like Cassini, that sort of thing. So a Discovery class mission would be like a Grail at the moon or MAVEN at Mars. New Frontiers class mission would be like Juno or OSIRIS-REx. And a flagship mission would be, like I said, Cassini or Magellan, those sorts of missions.
Mm. And something like the James Webb Space Telescope that's going to be launched hopefully in October. Is that a flagship mission or still something beyond, above a flagship?
Yeah, it would be super flagship, wouldn't it? Sometimes there are missions that are so compelling. The science is viewed as so important that the missions are directed. And usually the directed missions are the really expensive ones, like Hubble Space Telescope, like James Webb, or like Perseverance and Curiosity. And the reason for that is that the science community does not want to take the risk of the mission not being finished and launched, so not getting through to the development process, and they want it to last a long time when it gets to its destination. So James Webb is, I don't even remember what it cost, but the last I remember, the budget was up to $8 billion. It might even be higher than that now. And the reason it's so important is the Hubble Space Telescope isn't going to last forever. And the astronomy community feels they need something to replace it, and obviously they want better. So they're, you know, increasing the size of the mirror. They're going to a destination where they can do infrared, and there'll be a lot less light intrusion. So and you know, that destination means it's not serviceable. Well, that means that it has to be like guaranteed to work, you know, extremely reliable. And so that, again, drives the cost of the mission up.
I've often wondered, if we look at some of the planets, why is there this infatuation with Mars, the red planet, whereas Venus is much more spectacular to look at? Why Mars?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people look at Mars and they say, that's a picture of what Earth might look like someday. And Venus is too, by the way, but it's harder to see that at Venus, right? So the question is that, well, the questions that most space scientists are trying to answer are three fundamental questions. Where did we come from? Where are we going? And are we alone? And just about any space science question can be fit into one of those three categories. The where did we come from is important to it's important to understand what happened at other planets, because it may be the destiny of Earth. And so now we know why, or we think we know why Mars is mostly carbon dioxide. Right, because of the MAVEN mission, we know that the solar wind is shearing off the atmosphere because there's no coherent magnetic field at Mars. Well, you know, that means that we now understand a little bit more about how important the magnetic field is at Earth. There are lots of fundamental questions like that. You know, the oxygen isotopes at Jupiter that Juno is measuring tells us about how the planets were formed, and were they formed in their current locations or did they move around a bit? We're constantly drawing inference from Mars back to Earth. Just recently, some space scientists have looked at climate change at Venus and wound the models backward and found that likely Venus once was a water world just like Earth. That's kind of a new finding. And there was also that thing about finding possible constituents of life-forming compounds in the Venusian atmosphere. Currently, that's up for debate, but the modeling of what Venus was like a few million years ago was important, because now it tells us a little bit more about what has happened in our solar system and may enable us to help us understand, again, like I said, the destiny of Earth. Well, when you do that, it's the science that's important, not so much the mission itself. But the really interesting thing is, what the public really enjoys is the innovation and the vision associated with these missions. I mean, who would have ever thought to fly a drone at Mars? You know, one of the ways that we're looking at exploring Venus is with balloons. Those are things that captures people's attention and maintains the public awareness. So that we can select these missions and move forward.
Jim, I want to come back to the cost. Okay, you mentioned the various types of missions, Frontier and Discovery and Flagship and Super Flagship. If you would take the average total budget per year for, say, NASA, and I assume as far as space exploration is concerned, there may be budgets outside of NASA in the United States. But what fraction of the federal budget in the United States would that involve? Would that be to be a major space nation? Would that be something like 10%, 5%? Just to give a perspective, maybe how it compares with other priorities. Does it take a major chunk of the budget?
when we were running the Apollo program, NASA's budget was an enormous piece of the federal budget. And you'd have to do a little internet research to know the exact facts, but I'm remembering it's like on the order of 8 to 10% in the United States. Now, due to a large number of things, U.S. government priorities have shifted. NASA's gotten more efficient with dollars, those sorts of things. The entire NASA budget is generally about 0.5% of the federal government's expenditures. So for every tax dollar that's collected, 0.5 goes into goes to NASA. There's a lot of people that would like to see that grow quite a bit. We at NASA, I'm retired now, but we work for the American people, and that agenda is set by Congress and the administration and that sort of thing. So we follow the will of the people when that happens, you know, when they set up the budgets.
Mm-hmm. Now, would that 0.5% include those of other teams that work with NASA and do develop instruments, etc.? For example, if you would take the team, and they made quite an impression with their New Horizons mission of Alan Stern at an institute that many of us didn't even know it existed in South Africa, the Southwest Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
But they had this fantastic mission. But I understood they applied many times for funding over quite a number of years before they were successful. So how does a team like that relate with NASA and work with NASA?
An organization like Southwest Research, or even the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, has done the rovers and Juno, or the Applied Physics Laboratory, which has done many, many missions. They all receive the funds that they need to do space missions from NASA. And so when I say 0.5%, that 0.5% includes funding Dr. Alan Stern. By the way, he and I are close friends. And at times he has worked for me, and at other times I have worked for him. So, he's a fantastic scientist, and I hope someday you guys get the chance to interview him. But because the budget is so tight, there is this competitive process that's set up. And maybe I could take just like 5 minutes and describe that to you all. It might get a little long. Feel free to cut me off if it does. But every 10 years, the National Academy of Science in the U.S. gathers principal scientists space scientists together to talk about planetary science. In this particular case, the last report that they wrote was called a decadal survey. It was published in 2013, and there's a new one in the works right now, getting ready to be released for 2023. That document sets the agenda for the science for the next decade. It talks about how to continue what's been successful in the past decade and what we should be looking for in terms of the expansion of the science or the completion of the science in the next decade. And so in order to be assigned a mission, mostly, you have to submit a proposal to NASA that is reflective of one of the objectives within the decadal survey that was published associated with planetary science. New Horizons was, Juno was, the Discovery class missions are, although in the decadal survey, the New Frontiers class missions, the medium class missions, are actually named. So there was an asteroid sample return mission that was named in the decadal survey. And so that's how OSIRIS-REx got identified and then selected for a mission. There's a mission that will launch I think later this year, called Lucy, to some Trojan asteroids. Those are asteroids collected in gravity wells near Jupiter. That was also mentioned in the decadal survey. And so these gentlemen, they'll put together these proposals, and sometimes they'll be selected and sometimes they won't be. So these scientists will spend, well, in the case of the New Horizons, they spent 10 years trying to get the mission funded. And then they spent another 6 years building the mission. And then they spent 9 years in flight to Pluto. So, I mean, that's about the length of somebody's career, right? Just one mission to go that far out. But the budgets are so tight, the competition is so steep, and NASA wants to kind of spread the agenda around. You know, they want to go to Mars too many times, but, you know, want to give Venus a little bit of love and Jupiter, and we're kind of interested in what's going on at Pluto. And, of course, one of the compelling reasons to go to Pluto when we did was Pluto is moving away from the sun, and they were concerned that if there was any atmosphere at Pluto, that it would start to condense and then rain down on the surface, and we'd miss the chance to do classic spectroscopy of the atmosphere. There's that. There's this competitive process that NASA goes through, and that's why it takes these institutions so long. But if you hear of a NASA science mission, it's funded by NASA out of that 0.5% of the federal budget. There are other agencies in the U.S. that fund space science, but it's mostly operational things like weather forecasting and oceans monitoring and of course, the Department of Defense.
Jim, I've also wondered, isn't there room for a body like the United Nations, but in this case, United Space Nations?
Mm-hmm. And there is. And there's a group that meets every year in Vienna, Austria. They're a committee of the UN called the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And there they make joint resolutions, they make agreements and partnerships, they bring disagreements about things together. It's one of the places where the world is coming together to try and decide what to do in the event that there's an inbound hazardous asteroid detected. It's one of the places where people go to discuss what to do about orbital debris, for example. So, and then there's also adjunct to that, there's a space law group that's sponsored by the UN, and that governs things in the future, like who owns the artifacts that are left on the moon? Can any nation claim an asteroid to be their own? Can an organization go to a comet and mine it and bring it back and sell the products, or does that just belong to the world? You know, so there's those sorts of things as well. It's an important role that the UN plays in helping the nations of the world come together.
Talking about the time it takes some scientists to get their dream to have some measurements made from space or on objects in space, I remember when I was still quite young, 1997, I attended a workshop in Indiana in America, in South Bend, on micro lensing detection of planets. And during one of the sessions, they spoke about how advantageous it would be if they could do observations from space, and in particular, also, if they could get some parallax when they observe a microlensing event, the star gets brighter and dimmer because of an object that may contain a planet in front of that object being observed. And, well, I thought I was thinking big and say, well, you just need two observatories on different sides of the Earth observing simultaneously. And one of the young guys came, he proceeded with his with his talk and said, well, what we envisage is to do these observations from different sides of the solar system simultaneously. Yeah. So just growing up to think big like that. But I've noticed now, and I think it's the first time it's going to happen, is that they are going to do microlensing observations from the Nancy Roman Space Telescope. And that is now more than, it's now 24 years later after they have mentioned they want to do these observations from space. So sometimes, and that's also already a considerable part of someone's career, and they had to wait long for that exciting thing to happen now.
Yeah. And what's really cool is when people start talking about what to do in space, other people start getting innovative about what to do on Earth, right? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of stimulates innovation all the way around. When a science agenda is set by the National Academy of Science, it says we want to follow the water on Mars because we need to understand what happened to the climate on Mars. So we start looking at that, and other nations start sending missions to Mars that complement the U.S. agenda associated with water, or other nations may choose to do other destinations because they realize that the United States is going to focus on Mars, so Russia goes to Venus. You know, there's a variety of different reasons why these decadal surveys, once they're put together, are valuable documents for other organizations around the globe.
Right, we have to stop there. Jim, if somebody wants to communicate with you, it's via the Facebook group.
Always a pleasure. Happy to answer questions on the Facebook group. That's RSG Stira and Planeta on Facebook.
That's right.
Did I pronounce it right? I think I got it right.
Yeah, that's right. Marty, jou besonderhede?
Selfoonnommer 0836257154. 0836257154.
En dan die program se e-posadres sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Volgende week is ons terug. Tot dan. Alles van die beste.